Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, a leading Mideast churchman calls on Western and Arab governments to lead the push for peace in the region. Christ's agony in the garden. We go to Gethsemane in Jerusalem to reflect on Jesus' tormented last hours. And where do you find that scene depicted in the Vatican? We'll find out in a talk with art historian Elizabeth Lev. During this week of remembrance of the Lord's Passion, it seems only fitting that we turn our thoughts to the very place where Christ's final days actually played out. For decades, the land which Christians, Jews, and Muslims all call holy has been locked in what seems a never-ending cycle of violence and injustices. A leading Middle Eastern churchman is calling on Western powers to unite to find a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. After all, he says, they bear the responsibility for the creation of the new state.
We always have to remember that this problem in the Holy Land was created by the West 60 years ago. And the West should feel that it is basically their responsibility to help with the resolution of the problem.
Lebanese Archbishop Paul Sayah is the Maronite Archbishop in Israel and the Patriarchal Vicar in Jerusalem, Jordan, and Palestine.
Now, I am not by any means trying to minimize the responsibility of the locals, but the locals are caught up in a dead end. You know, the Israelis and the Palestinians can never resolve the problem on their own. First of all, the lack of trust among them is something phenomenal. So if you don't trust the other, you'll never be able to get into dialogue with the other. Besides, they don't have the capability, even if they trusted each other, because for the Palestinians in particular, they are part of this environment. They're part of the milieu of the Middle Eastern environment. And if some of the Middle Eastern states are in conflict, you know, the Palestinians will remain in conflict with each other. And the other problem is that if the Palestinians don't get their act together and unite, no solution will ever be found. We hope that the division was not created in order not to find a solution to the problem. You know, it's a good excuse to say there's no interlocutor, there's nobody to dialogue with. Of course, if the Palestinians are divided, there's nobody to dialogue with. But at the same time, the way to help the Palestinians come together is not to say, we don't speak to this, we don't speak to that, we don't do this, we don't do that. I think one should not simply diagnose the problem, but one should try to find a solution to the problem. Why are the Palestinians divided? Of course, there are reasons. Hamas says we were elected democratically and you didn't accept our election. And then, of course, it's not as simple as that. But at the same time, I feel when the Arab countries are divided, it's very difficult for the Palestinians to come together because each one of the factions seems to be looking over the shoulder to somebody else in the region. For example, if Syria and Egypt are not on good terms, if Syria, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia are not on good terms, it's very difficult to come to a solution. So I feel that the sooner the Western powers really show a real will for peace, the better. You know, otherwise, any delay will play into the hands of Hamas. especially any feeling on the part of Abu Mazen that the Americans and the Western states are not supporting him as they are saying they are. This is playing definitely into the hands of Hamas, who are telling them, look, fine, you went the American way, look where they led you to. And the people are really frustrated. And I'm afraid if there are elections now, we don't know how things will go. And I would not be surprised if Hamas won the elections again. The problem is that we're for everybody. We're for Israel. We're for Palestine. We're for America. We're for the West. It's to everybody's interest to do it. I think Israel is on a suicidal track the way it's going. They simply are not looking far enough. They're looking to the immediate future. And this is very, very dangerous. The Palestinians are so frustrated and that they can, I think, end up doing anything because they don't see any light in the tunnel. And, you know, this is, again, a recipe for another intifada, a recipe for more violence.
Arab countries did find rare unity back in 2002 when the Arab League unanimously adopted the Arab Peace Initiative in Beirut, calling for Israel's withdrawal to pre-1967 boundaries and the establishment of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. In return, Arab states would agree to a comprehensive peace with Israel. Different Israeli leaders have both rejected the plan outright or suggested some of its proposals are a starting point. So many years have gone by, though, I wonder if the Arab Peace Initiative isn't dead already in the water.
No. Thank God it's not dead, because I think this is the only initiative that is viable. And the problem is that I think very few people are talking about this initiative. Why? Because each one has his or her own agenda. To be honest, I don't think everybody is really looking for peace the way they talk about it. I think they should put their action where their words are. You know, they talk about peace. But what are they doing? I mean, here is an initiative which, in my opinion, is fair to everybody. You can't leave the Palestinians without a state. You can't leave Israel exposed to violence. You have to find a way where Israel can have a safe and secure country and where also the Palestinians have their own state as well. And the only way, I feel, is to go back to the UN resolutions. You know, if we are to live in a world of law, we have to try to abide by the law, all of us. So this is why I feel that, thank God, this initiative is not dead. But for how long will it be on the table? I don't know.
And a warm thanks there to Maronite Archbishop Paul Saya, Patriarchal Vicar in Jerusalem, Jordan, and Palestine. Well, one thing that is not likely to improve efforts for peace in the Holy Land are Israeli plans for excavations of the basin around the old city of Jerusalem, a project which critics say is not transparent and is likely to further inflame passions there through Jewish appropriation of land in and around Arab East Jerusalem. Brussels-based Father Paul Lansou, senior policy advisor on security and disarmament for the international peace movement Pax Christi, says that's not helping the peace process.
It seems a strategy of the settler movement to continue their territorial outreach, now more and more also in East Jerusalem with linking the settlements, etc. I think this is not a good thing, and the lack of transparency. In fact, you don't read that much about it in the newspapers or not even in documents. So there's a kind of a secrecy behind it, and that scares me a bit, because the information we got here seems that there's a kind of a movement of settlers. They take their freedom to decide and to go on with building new settlements with the result of home demolitions of Palestinians, etc. And that scares me a bit. It's not good also for a democratic country. That's really not positive.
Father Paul is urging Christians to make pilgrimages to the Holy Land to see for themselves the facts on the ground and support the local churches there.
I think if you come and see, come and see. It's also a biblical expression. Come and see what's going on. Listen to the people. I think that's a very fundamental Christian approach of situations like of conflict situations like here in the Holy Land. Come and see. So they have an idea about what's going on, and with that information, with the facts on the ground and with their analysis, I think it's good that they go home and that they express themselves about what's going on, that they try to convince their colleague to be aware as well, and to and in fact to invite others from the Christian community at home to come over to the Holy Land, because I think that's the best thing to do, that is to bring people to the Holy Land, and that they see what's going on the ground, and that they have an idea, that they can make up their mind about what's going on. And certainly, and that's for sure a necessity, everybody who has been here, they should try to contact their political authorities at home, on the national level for sure, but also maybe in our case for Pax Christi International, also on the European level, or even on the level of the United Nations, because we have a status to these bodies. So I think awareness raising, that could lead also to a kind of a mobilization of Christians worldwide to be more aware of what's going on with the Mother Church here in the Holy Land.
Hillside opposite the ancient stone walls of Jerusalem, commanding a sweeping view of the valley below. It's the small olive grove where Christ prayed to be delivered from the terrible destiny that was soon to befall him. But Christ, who humbly accepted his fate, was to endure his torment in solitude. His three disciples had fallen asleep nearby. Well, since the 4th century, the faithful have included the Garden of Olives, or Gethsemane, in their pilgrimages to the places of the Lord's Passion. Today, pilgrims can stroll through the small grove and pray or stop to reflect on Christ's last hours among the gnarled, wizened olive trees shading the garden paths. In the early 20th century, the Franciscans, with the financial help of many nations, built a new basilica over the ruins of a 4th-century church and the rubble of a Byzantine shrine. The faithful can also visit the Grotto of the Betrayal, the place where for centuries local Christians have believed Christ was betrayed by Judas. As part of our series of Lenten reflections on Christian sites in the Holy Land, scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us up the hill to the Garden of Gethsemane, recalling the agony of that night.
The site is a most impressive, appealing one, even today. One finds in the garden surrounding the Church of All Nations massive olive trees, and botanists are able to say, yeah, as a matter of fact, one or two of those are 2,000 years old.
So they would have been there.
They would have been witnesses, living witnesses to the Lord's agony in the garden. And if one goes from the cenacle down to the Garden of Olives, St. John tells us in his gospel that Jesus went through the Kidron Valley and he passed over the Kidron Stream. And we're thinking, why mention that little piece of geography? Who cares? They had to cross a stream. Well, as a matter of fact, as the sacrifices were being immolated at the temple in preparation for the Passover, that stream, there was a channel or a canal, if you will, from the site of the sacrifices of the lambs. So the blood went down into that stream.
So this is during Passover.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when John tells us that Jesus passed over the Kidron stream, one can see that he can look into that stream and see the blood of the lambs.
And that's another passing over.
Exactly. Another passing over. He passes over that. And as a matter of fact, all of the blood that's going down in that stream that night is going to be fulfilled in his shedding of his blood the next day. So it's a marvelous piece of information. John is not only just a great theologian, but he's an incredibly sensitive and subtle writer. And you get these little tidbits which seem like, oh, cute, clever, interesting piece of information. But as a matter of fact, if you look a little deeper, you find that there's a profound theological truth that he's trying to convey there. At any rate, once again, that inner circle, Peter, James, and John, that are with Jesus on the Mount of the Transfiguration, that are with him for the raising of the daughter of Jairus, are now with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And what do? They sleep. And St. Thomas More has a wonderful book called The Sadness of Christ, which he wrote while he was in the Tower of London. And it's an extended meditation on the agony in the garden. And he makes a somewhat cynical but telling comment. He says, in England at this moment, there are people claiming that the bishops are not the successors of the apostles. And he said, and that is completely false, and it's proven by this agony in the garden. He says, Peter, James, and John, among the first bishops in the church, as a matter of fact, slept through our Lord's most pitiful moment. He said, just as the bishops in England today are sleeping while the persecution of the church is going on. Of course, he was referring to the fact that only one bishop in England refused to sign the oath of supremacy, St. John Fisher, who was martyred as a result, and the papal nuncio. All the other bishops collaborated. And the message isn't simply about bishops being unfaithful to Christ. It's, as a matter of fact, Christians historically do exactly the same thing. We are asleep at the switch. Instead of identifying with Christ in his passion, we prefer to do other things, whether that's physical sleep or all kinds of distracting activities, so that we get our mind off something as annoying as following a suffering Christ.
Gethsemane was also the site where, of course, Jesus was betrayed by a kiss.
That's right. And that shows the depth of the malevolence, to use a symbol of friendship to betray. Many spiritual writers throughout the centuries have made the observation that what made our Lord sweat the drops of blood, which of course there is good medical evidence that can indeed happen, was not the prospect of the physical suffering, but that he was able in his intense humanity and at the same time joined to his divine person, able to see the betrayal of Judas, the denial of Peter, but also the disunity in his church throughout history. And this is what weighed on his sacred heart and on his mind more than anything else. And this is what caused this intense suffering and the agony in the garden. So that, as a matter of fact, and seeing the sins of the world until the end of time, not so much the crucifixion, that would have been over within a few hours, but that the agony of Christ continues, we can say, through the sins that are committed day in and day out by you and by me.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted scholar and author and editor of The Catholic Response. Though it's one of the pivotal and certainly most tragic moments of Christ's passion, the agony in the garden has not been widely depicted in art, or at least less so than other events from his last days. Art historian Elizabeth Lev tells us where one scene of the agony is depicted here in the Vatican, and she points to more modern forms of art that have expressed it too.
There's one very small image of the agony in the garden represented by Cosimo Rosselli, one of the painters of the Sistine Chapel in the 1480s. But it's a very small window. It's actually part of the last panel on the right-hand side panels of the Stories of Christ. And it's the Last Supper with three windows looking outside of the room of the Last Supper. And the first window on the left shows this agony in the garden. But
so you're actually in the room of the Last Supper and you can see through the windows and you see the agony in the garden.
You see the agony in the garden, you see the arrest, and you see the crucifixion. So you see how these stories from the moment of the Last Supper, from Holy Thursday and the Last Supper, the story telescopes into the Passion of Christ. So everything is summed up in one single page. The Vatican Agony in the Garden, very, very small representation, is really one of the very, very few images of this sort that you will see in Rome. In this city, there's something of a dearth of Agony in the Garden scenes, and actually in the history of art, there are very few. There's a flurry right around the late 1400s and the early 1500s in which you get some of the finest painters, Andrea Mantegna, Giovanni Bellini, the great Venetian painters all take a stab at this image of the Agony of the Garden. They all represent it in the same way, and by the way, the same way that Cosimo Rosselli represents the image. Three apostles asleep in the lowest corner of the painting, the part that's closest to the viewer. Jesus raised up on a mount, generally with his back to us, so we don't really see what's going on. And in some images that derive from St. Luke, particularly Mantegna's as well as Rosselli's, in these images they have the angel that brings the chalice or some indication of the Jesus who sweat drops of blood and the angel who came to strengthen him in this struggle. But amazingly enough, the thing that I find particularly interesting about talking about this subject is that some works of art take a long time to create an iconography. So, for example, our vision of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin, which everybody's mind, Mary wearing the white with the light blue, and she's standing on a serpent, and she's standing, and you've got the crown of stars around her head. This imagery that immediately will come to everyone's mind. It took 800 years to create that image. And what I found when I was thinking about this and looking through all the images, that the person who really captured the spirit of the Agony of the Garden was actually, captured in cinema. It took cinema to create the idea of the Agony of the Garden. And when
You'll have to explain that one, because we didn't have cinema until what, 1920?
Until 2001 is where I'm going, or 2003. And the arrival of the movie The Passion, which many people have many different issues with, but there are many things that perhaps are not the consecration of iconography. However, the Agony of the Garden in the Garden, I do not think has ever been better depicted. It's the opening of the movie. It's drawn, the whole story of the movie is drawn and supplemented not only from the gospel but from the visions of the Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. But this the word agony comes from the Greek agone. It is only used once in the gospel, and the word means struggle. Piazza Navona here in Rome is actually from the term agone, which are the agonistic games, the competitions that took place in the Piazza Navona, when it was the Stadium of Domitian. They use this term once in the gospel. They use it for Jesus's struggle in the garden and this preparation. And the way that Mel Gibson captures this heroic Christ, you know, beaten to the ground with his fear, then getting up and getting ready to face the battle. Really, it opens up a whole new way of thinking about, a way of meditating on, a way of feeling close to one of the hardest aspects of Christ's passion. You know, we the physical torture we all know about, we have plenty of images of, but that emotional difficulty of knowing what's ahead. He's God, he knows what's coming. And then to have his friends all falling asleep, to have his friends left behind. So the sense of abandonment with which he goes into the ring. And I would like to just bring up that in the history of Christian art and literature, this idea that the agony of the garden presents to us, of the hero who awaits the moment of battle, the hero who's getting ready to step out into the ring, it has been picked up and created some of the greatest works of art that you and I know. For example, Michelangelo's famous David in the Academia, where it's not David in the middle of the ring, it's not David after the battle, it's David in that moment when he prepares to step out and face Goliath. It's a very interesting thing to remember in our world, that as much as Hollywood or the pop culture, or even, you know, pop music tries to deny it, a great many of our most powerful forms of imagery, they come from the Christian tradition.
Let's go back a moment to this image in the Sistine Chapel. Here we look at these three apostles who are lying with their backs to Jesus, who's there on the mount praying. And in a way, I think we Christians, we see ourselves mirrored in these three disciples who do have our backs turned to Jesus. We've left him in his moment of dire need.
All these images, more so than the Cosimo Rosselli, which of course is a papal commission, but the actual panel paintings of the Agony in the Garden are usually private commissions. They're commissioned by wealthy gentlemen, people who put them up as a kind of private devotional piece. And in that particular form of commission, that's exactly what this is about. The emphasis tends to be on the apostles, who, as a matter of fact, if you see in this image, a lot of them, or if you somebody Googles them or pulls out an art book, you'll find them in these very good artists such as Mantegna and Bellini, who were experts at foreshortening, that is, making a part of the body seem close to you and part of the body seem far away from you. You'll find that the bodies of one of the apostles is usually foreshortened towards you. So it's really a link to you in looking towards the painting. So this is sort of a radical shift that takes place when these images were first commissioned, or this flurry of commissions in the late 1400s. They represent more of a meditation on our own inadequacy to be a friend to Jesus in need, our own incapacity to stay awake, to stay with him all the way through to the end. And at the same time, it does re-emphasize Christ's loneliness, because from that you can extrapolate, you can project into, you know, Jesus alone on the mountain suffering. But I think the Renaissance is very much a very humanocentric age, something that they're concerned a lot about the patron. The patron sees himself, the patron wants to put himself. So I think actually what makes the modern shift interesting is to put the focus back on Jesus again.
And thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.